This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This episode is brought to you by Twizzlers. Long day, late night, feeling a little bored. Twizzlers is the ultimate sidekick for any moment of the day, no matter what kind of day you're having. The perfect level of sweet and a fun excuse to sit back and relax. Unwind with Twizzlers. To buy now, visit Hersheyland.com/Twizzlers.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Underrated Movie Podcast. This is a podcast where we discuss films that are underrated, underappreciated, and ones that have just flown under the radar and passed most people by. Today, we're going to be talking about one of my absolute favorite films, Gangs of New York, a 2002 epic historical film directed by the man himself, Martin Scorsese. The screenplay by Jay Cox, Steve Zalian, Kenneth Logman, based on the Herbert Ashley 1927 book. The film, of course, stars Leonardo DiCaprio, Daniel Day-Lewis, Cameron Diaz, and a number of character actors. I am your host, Derek McDuff, and joining me as a guest co-host is a man who needs no introduction, but I will still introduce him. That is Karosh Jozavi. How's it going, Karosh?
Thank you for having me. Pleasure to be back hanging out with you. It's always fun talking movies with you. And yeah, my name is Karosh. I'm Cujo Prime on all platforms. I'm a streamer. I'm a YouTuber, interviewer, panelist. I don't know. Just kind of like everything creative that we do in this field of pop culture, movies, games, whatever. But it's good to be here. I'm excited to talk about this movie.
Yeah, because last time I had you on my other podcast, my Marvel one, Infinity Stones and Dragon Bones, and we talked about one of the worst movies ever made, Morbius. So now we're talking about one of my favorites. So
we're taking it in a positive direction.
Yeah. So so it's a nice change. But yeah, thank you for being on. Karosh is the best. You know, somebody I've met a handful of times in real life, but you know, we've talked a bunch online, and of course. This is the guy who got me into Comic-Con, so
yeah, I'm glad about that. I'm glad I got you. Like it's for me that my first Comic-Con is always like a memorable experience. And I'm glad I could be a part of someone else's too. So, you were such a great help in the panel I had with the photography and stuff. So I credit you for that too. Appreciate that.
Thank you. I was happy to help, happy to be there, and yeah, that was. A great panel. Honestly, I had a blast watching you. But yeah, so I guess without any further ado, we'll get into the film itself, which, originally when we were talking, I gave you a big old list of movies.
Such a good list.
Thank you.
If no one else wants to talk about those movies with you, I would happily come back.
Oh, I'll definitely have you back. Okay. Yeah, the one you went to, as you say, have a list of great movies, but the one that you chose to talk about was Gangs of New York. So why was that your number one pick of that list?
I don't often get, like, the other ones I've had, I love talking movies with various friends, groups, and, with yourself and other friends that we both know and stuff. And this is one that I don't think almost ever comes up, or no one ever, like, has anything to talk about. So I was like, this is a little different. Like when people think Scorsese, I don't see this brought up hardly ever. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I feel like it fits very much in the theme. It's underrated. It doesn't get appreciated enough. And I feel like this would be if the fact that it was on your list, I'm like, okay, cool. I'm curious what your thoughts are, what we vibe on, or what resonates.
Yeah, absolutely. I think like you said, this is. I think people generally think it's a good movie, but it's not one that ever gets talked about with the Scorsese classics or even his newer films that people like a lot. It's got like a 71% on Rotten Tomatoes, which is like fine, like it's fresh, but it's not like for a Scorsese movie. You're like, that's low.
Yeah, I feel like if it were by any other director, it would maybe have gotten talked about more. Mm-hmm. But because he has so many other films that people are always like, they're referring to, you know, The Departed or, you know, every other film that he's like been a part of in any fashion, it kind of gets, yeah, like you said, overlooked.
Yeah, and I think one statistic that perfectly sums up, I think, this movie's reputation. That year at the Academy Awards, so it would have been 2003's Academy Awards, it was nominated for 10 awards, including pretty much all the big ones. Picture, Best Director. Actor, yes, Director, Goose Egg. It went home with nothing.
Wow.
Yeah, so that sums up. Like, people like this movie, but it's like, it's not that much. Like, you know.
I don't remember. Did it not even get Best, like, Supporting Actor?
No, I don't think it got. Did Leo get nominated? I don't have the list in front of me of all of
it. Well, I was more thinking. I don't know if we're. I'm guessing Daniel Day-Lewis was maybe categorized as supporting, but if he was whichever category, if he got nominated, I'm surprised he didn't win.
So I'll go down the list. So it got Best Sound, Original Song, which that's the one I don't think it deserved because I don't like you two. But Film Editing, Costume Design, Cinematography, Art Direction. All that makes sense.
The technical stuff.
Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, and this movie looks incredible, so that that makes a lot of sense. But then screenplay, Day-Lewis got actor, supporting actor, but actor, and then, like we said, director and picture.
Okay. Okay, well.
Yeah, yeah. So then we've talked about the movie's reputation and stuff, but what about the guts of the film itself? What do you think about this movie? What's your Karoche official review?
So the first time I remember this movie very specifically because I was still I was born in Oklahoma, and I remember we had a local theater. I was in a small town and we had a local theater, and we'd see most of the movies I'd see there. But sometimes we do, like, it'd be like a weekend trip and we'd make it to like Tulsa or Oklahoma City. That was like a fun weekend, for instance. And we'd sometimes be like, hey, let's go to dinner, we'll go to the mall. And I remember my dad and I, my mom was like busy doing something else. My dad's like, hey, let's go see this movie. And I was still at that age where I was like, I wasn't sure if I could see rated R movies or not. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't my first rated R, but it definitely was one of the most intense first ones I've seen. And in the performances that I saw and in the subject matter and everything. And it just left this imprint on my head with everything from the whistling music and the drums to the performances from everyone to just the overall tone of it. It just, I don't know how to capture it, but it was just intense. And the performances really grabbed me at that age. And now I've watched it this past weekend just to be like, you know, let's maybe take some of that nostalgia lens off and see what, like, how I feel about it recently. And I still feel like I have some criticisms, but I think by and large, the things I enjoyed about it still resonate for me. There are just some things that I'm like, it feels like there are dated elements to it, but it's just like rough around the edges. But to me, that epitomizes what this is. Like, the subject matter was rough around the edges. The characters were rough around the edges. Everything about this was rough around the edges. And I kind of liked that. That was like an appeal to me.
Yeah, no, I totally get what you're saying, because it does feel a little bit like, a little bit dirtier, a little bit grittier. Scorsese tends to be a little, like, you know, very clean. Like, he'll have those, like, long takes and moving through all the things, and everyone's very precise. And this one just feels less precise, you know? So, yeah, I appreciate
and
that.
The opening scene today, to this day, is one of my favorite opening scenes.
Mm-hmm.
With the beginning of the 5 points and everything and that music. And I'm like, yeah, that's probably, like, the one of them. And then just from there, yeah, so. That's yeah. Fine. What about for you?
Yeah, no, I mean, I love this movie. Like I said, it's one of my favorites. This is a movie, like, you know how, like, some dudes, like, Fight Club is their, like, thing, you know? Like, I feel like for a teenage Derek, Gangs in New York was my thing. Like, I didn't see it until I was probably in high school, but I kind of always, like, it had this, like, for whatever reason, I was like, I really want to watch this Gangs in New York movie. It looks awesome. Looks like it's got all these fights and stuff like that in it. And I had seen The Departed. And I remember being like, this is cool, but this looks like The Departed, but like old timey and awesome. And so I watched it and I was instantly like really on board. And I think like a lot of people, the first time though, I was like, that was so good. But the ending, I don't know about the ending. But I think like over the next couple of years, and especially now, I think that the ending is really what makes the movie. I think that is like it's almost an anticlimax, but I feel like that is perfect. You get these like almost you know it starts with this big battle that seems to set up everything, and then you know you follow this course of this you know this guy Amsterdam and this path of revenge that he's trying to take against Bill the Butcher, and it's just this generational feud that, like Brendan Gleeson has said, it's been going on for like 1,000 years or more. Yeah. And like, you know, Valen, he could have just left. He should have just, you know, but he's been spending his whole life getting ready to come back and take vengeance on this guy. And then this guy becomes like a pseudo father figure to him. And he's all messed up about that, especially when he saves his life, which I think is one of the best sequences of the movie. And then they have that talk.
Yeah.
But the way it builds and builds and builds toward that ending is they have this feud. And I love that it's like interspersed with Civil War stuff, which the first time I saw this, I thought it was like, oh yeah, it's just like table setting. Like it just is set in the Civil War because that's the time period, whatever. It's just, but it's ultimately like, yeah, you have this feud. You have these two people, there's two groups fighting of this old conflict that literally does not matter. They came to this new world and it doesn't matter at all. There's this whole, they're in this world that is now tearing itself apart, that has no care or disdain for their old feud. And there's a new, much bigger new feud that they're just ignoring. And it's going on in the background to the point where like the riots are happening and elephants are stampeding. But like, whatever, we don't care. We're just here to kill each other.
I was going to comment on that elephant scene was so weird to me.
It's so weird. And it's very like 2002 CGI. But you're like, they linger
on it too.
And yeah. I'm like, it is like set up rewatching it. You're like, oh, they go to Barnum like 2 or 3 times. But then it all, like, you're ready for like the big final battle. But then this other thing that's been happening in the background of the movie literally explodes in their face.
Yeah, yeah.
And then instead of like trying to kill each other, like you see like them like carrying each other out. Like it's like they should have been paying attention to this all along. Leto should have just like left for San Francisco with Cameron Diaz, or should have not come to the first place. And their whole thing doesn't matter. They've just been ignoring the real world to focus on their petty squabble. And in the end, none of it mattered. He does technically kill him in the end, but that's after he's already gotten like a mortal wound from some shrapnel. So for me, like the ending is what makes the whole movie so much more powerful.
Yeah, I think I agree with you. I've had a hard time coming to any sort of real, like, where do I sit with how it ends? Mm-hmm. I remember initially when I was younger, I was very just like, I was just more and more, they kept building to this confrontation between these two characters. This guy's been building and plotting and brooding. And I was like, oh, we're going to get like a duel or a battle or a conflict and stuff. And it kind of goes out in a bit of, like you said, like it's a little bit of a whimper, but also a little bit of like they've been so focused on each other that they're missing this whole other thing happening that just takes them both off the rails. But like, I think it's what brings it back to like what those characters were. They had their convictions, they had their virtues or the lack of. I think that was one of the things that Bill's point was, your father was a man of virtue, a man of he had his beliefs, and you have none. You will do anything, whatever. You have no. You're aimless. Like you're, and you're even. And I think Valen had maybe there was some frustration there too of like why he was so angry with him. He's like, I like him. I don't like him. I like this. I don't like this. I kind of go with whatever sway the city takes me or he takes me or whatever. And he's like, what do I like? Why am I doing this? And I think, by the end of it, regardless of whether it mattered or not, like him having something to stand behind, having something to believe in, which was like, we coming in by the thousands, why are we so afraid of these folk, these natives, quote unquote, and rising up for like having something to believe in. And so I think that was, I felt some sort of like progress in where the story and the characters' feelings were. But it was like the world will keep moving regardless of those things. And it's dangerous to ignore that, to neglect that as they saw, because their conflicts just had so much collateral on that city that like, they just were like, yeah, screw this. We're going to, like, Tammany, whatever, votes this. Like, we run the streets. We're kids in a bit. They're like, no, we're part of a bigger world now. The world keeps... And I think that's what even happens at the beginning with the 5 points. They're like, they had this... The scale of things was smaller, but it was similar in that it was these small folks, you know, fighting over a larger space. And then now they're smaller folks fighting in an even larger space. And there's just this bigger world and this bigger city that this is all the bed of. And so I do find a new appreciation for the movie in that sense of, like, it was like kind of like Scorsese's way of infusing a bit of that mafia style of film that he's kind of gotten notorious for, but also of, like, being like, here's a love letter to the, you know, the history of New York, maybe, or the beginnings of our country in that area or something.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with that. I think Leo's character development in this movie is really interesting. I think one of the moments that speaks the most to that is when he, rather than killing Johnny, he's like, all right, just get out of town, man. Like, I think that was a really, really cool moment. And, you know, you're talking about all the stuff with the Irish immigrants and stuff like that, and how it's something that is still, like, so important today. Immigrants come to this country now, and... You know, that's where Scorsese pulls out his one long, like his oneer, is when
with the shot. Yeah.
Oh my God, that shot is incredible, because, you know, you see the immigrants coming off the boat, and then it kind of, like, sweeps, and they're like, it's like, all right, this is the document that makes you a citizen, this is what makes you in the army, and then it kind of sweeps around, and they're all getting dressed, and one's like, do we get fed now? And then it goes on the boat, and then on that same boat, it's like craning off this dead bodies in the cow, and you're like, God damn it, Marty, he really knows how to direct a fucking movie.
Yeah. So, just kind of just painting a scene, painting a picture, and just without any real, like, just subtly and just so fluidly. It was so good. And, like, yeah, and part of that, I remember one of the things was, like, after they've signed, they're like, their families are leaving. It's like, you came to bring your families here, and now this is the cost that it's having for providing for them, for them to figure something out, maybe. I thought the other stuff was, like, the politics stuff when they had... You know, where everyone else was, and then also where the high class people were. I don't know if you noticed, Scorsese's one of those high class people.
I never caught that. Is he?
Yeah, earlier on, they cut to it in the end a lot more, but earlier on, there was one dinner scene, and he was sitting at the table of this family, and you just see him like, yes, and he's all dressed uppity and everything. I was like, oh, okay, there you are, Marty. But yeah, just that separation of class as well in this conflict, and, like, even though they're, like, saying everyone's drafted, they're kind of the ones absolved of this. They're like, you don't need it. Like, you are the ones instructing everyone where to go, what to vote for. And, like, a little bit of commentary on that aspect of our society, I think, still is relevant to this day. But, and the roster, the cast was, even then, I was like, back then, I was like, damn, these are so, and looking back now, I'm like, there's a lot of big names then that, and also many names that became bigger after.
Yeah, yeah. Is this the last time John C. Reilly had a serious role? Because he's so good as he's, like, Happy Jack, the policeman who sucks. Then he just, like, after this, he started, like, hanging out with Will Ferrell and just did comedies. But, you know, like, he even had that bit in the Oscars where he's like, you can be both. He's like, what does he say? He's like, you can be both in comedies and dramas. I was both in Boogie and Talladega Nights. And then he didn't really ever do any more dramas after this. This was the end of kind of a John C. Reilly age.
I think there was maybe one other film that was after this that was like a dramedy. It was like a satirical kind of like sad indie drama film, but it was still very kind of comedic. But yeah, I think by and large, like, the only other, everything after this, all I think of is, you know, Dr. Brulé and Talladega.
yeah, honestly, like, yeah, once he, like, was in, like, Walk Hard and stuff, there was no turning back.
Yeah, yeah. There were some great performances, though. Like, I love, you know, like you said, Brendan Gleeson. He's a favorite of mine. Yeah. His role, like, very much, it was few, but it was impactful. He has a presence to him.
Yeah, he's good.
It was perfectly captured in the way the character was, too. He was just notorious for having this bludgeon with these notches, and I was like, yeah, that's imposing. Like, his everything he does is imposing, and it matches who he is and his kind of demeanor and everything. Were there any particular performances that you resonated with?
I mean, yeah, like, Gleeson was obviously great. I think that Day-Lewis, obviously, you know, he's so good in this, and you know, he gets a little flat for like his method. I think it's like one of those things. It's like we celebrate the method acting when we like the guy, but when we don't like the guy, we like point out how crappy he is, because he has literally the same style of acting as Jared Leto. but he's a good actor, and Jared Leto's not as good.
I think maybe Day-Lewis does it maybe not as much to the detriment of others, whereas as well, much. I don't know.
Yeah, I was going to say, because there's stories, even from this movie, somebody else who I was going to bring up who I think is great in this in a small role, Liam Neeson, so good in this. He fucking hates Daniel Day-Lewis.
Really? Because, oh my God, I did not know.
Because whenever, like between takes and stuff like that, Liam Neeson would be grabbing like a cup of coffee or something. He's like, "Priest, are you enjoying that coffee?" And he's like, "Can you just stop for like, you Irish mother whore?" Like, he would just like say all this like horrible shit to him. And it's just like, "Oh my God, can you fucking stop, man? We're like between takes."
That's hilarious. I can only, that's such an intense character too.
Yeah, like it's like that would get so old, you know.
Yeah, I know I would definitely need a few drinks of maybe more than just coffee, maybe a little Irish coffee or something.
Yeah. And okay, and well, yeah, and then one other person I was gonna say is, you know, his buddy Johnny. Do you know who plays Johnny? I like looked him up to see if he was in anything else. Do you know what he's from?
I know I've seen his face before. I don't know what from though.
Imagine him much, much younger and hanging out with Drew Barrymore and maybe going trick-or-treating.
What? No way!
Yeah, he's Elliot from E.T.
Oh, no way. Yeah, wow.
Yeah, right?
Who knew Elliot was a little snitch?
Right?
Who knew?
Right? He's such a little fucker this
movie. I hated him so much in this film.
Yeah.
So many times, yeah. Take a hint, man.
Yeah, dude, she is not that into you, dude.
Yeah. I mean, he plays the character really well. I'll give him that.
He's like, good.
Like the way he's just like, just kind of like cowardice, but also kind of like standing up for himself and has a little bit of like a moral dilemma of how he's doing stuff, confessing to Valen. So he has his journey, but like, I personally couldn't stand him.
No, he's a little fucking rat. Yeah. Like the best is when that, like, he's like, okay, cool, I'm gonna go dance with her. And then they're like, no. And he's like, and they're like, no, really, go.
Like, she said no to you.
Yeah.
Like, it could not be more clear.
Right? Yeah. Oh, man. But then, also, I was going to say, I remember, like, the narrative being around this movie for, like, a long time. It's like, it's got one or maybe even two, like, all-time great performances. And then they're like, and one of the worst. And rewatching this time, I was like, people, like, shit on Cameron Diaz. And maybe her really? Irish accent isn't the best, but, like, that was like a running, like, I remember even like there was like a Cracked article, like it was like the movies where there's one great performance and the worst, and like it was like number one or two on the list, and it's like people just hated Cameron Diaz.
Wow.
And I was like, realize. Yeah, I thought she was fine. I thought she was pretty good in this.
She was okay. Like, she gave me Selena Kyle, like Catwoman kind of vibes, like, I don't know, thief making ends meet, kind of does take it under the wing, by any means necessary kind of thing. I don't think it stood out to me in a very positive or negative way. It was fine. Like you said, it was fine. I think some of the stuff, though, in this film was very stylized in the sense of, like, I mean, the butcher, obviously, like, that was just super over the top. But other characters, too, were just, like, I think satire or, like, exaggerations of folks of those times. Like, I think Tweed.
I was gonna say, Jim Broadbent in this. He is doing, burying a lot of votes down there. Ooh, you know.
Yeah, he's really hamming up the political. Yeah. You know, like all the. He's like, we got to get votes into the boots. This and that, like a vote for Tammany is a vote for, you know, all this.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, if anyone's being over the top or really ridiculous, his was, but it fit. Like that fit. But Bill the Butcher's fit because he was just this boisterous, almost Uncle Sam-esque. Join like kind of mafia boss in some ways, also patriot obviously in his own ways, and then you had like McGlowan as like the most, like, I thought he was the most like over exaggerated Irishman
in
the way he was like, oh, you know, like, I'm ready for a fight and all this, like, you know, stuff, whatever, and I'm like, Jesus, like, okay, sure. I mean, again, it seemed like the overall tone of the film had these hyper stylized folks on every end of the spectrum, and then you had some folks that, and then it would go from there, and then would get like gritty and like simmering to a degree of like, we're going to bring it to a fine boil with the, between how these characters feel about their beliefs and their revenge and their thoughts. Cause you could tell like every time, I think that's where Valen was, or Amsterdam was most like conflicted, was like, he hated this man for everything he'd done. And he swore revenge kind of. And, but he would also see out of any, like no one, everyone that was on his the priest's side has switched or moved sides or lost their way. The only person that's like honoring him or puts respect in that man's name since that day that he died was Bill.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm like, that's such a conflict. I'm like, I'd be twisted too. I'm like, I mean, the fact that he did what he did, but also like that he's the only one like honoring him, remembering him to like an intense degree, like do not fault. No one earns respect but that man kind of thing.
Don't knock over the picture. And then, like you're saying, like, you know, with the performances, like he's a very much larger than life character. So I think you kind of need that, like that just like ridiculous, boisterous, like over the, I cut out my own eye, you know, character. To have Leo just be like caught up in the cult of him, and to be like, you know, and you see everyone has switched sides. It makes sense because he is just so intense and powerful. And you're like, this guy does have this cult of personality that feels like it really can run the underground of the city. Yeah. And I love one thing. I love this ties back to what you were saying about the musical motif of like the drums and the whistle, is that you get that echoed every time he sees someone from the, he's like, oh, this guy was fighting on my dad's side. This guy was fighting. And they're like, they come back and, you know, you see them and it's like, and it's playing again. I think, the only, and she's not a major character, but the only one other one who doesn't really switch sides is Hellcat Maggie, who I think is like a minor character, but is drunk. She's just like a random drunk badass who like has like fucking cat claws and shit. I was like, I don't know who you are. I don't know what your whole deal is, but fucking you're awesome. I would watch a whole movie about her. Like, so that was a lot of fun. But yeah. I really think this movie, you know, coming out in 2002, it's the start of Leo's collaboration with Scorsese. It's kind of at the perfect nexus of the latter and early Scorsese, because it's a throwback to like all the old like Mean Streets and like Goodfellas and stuff.
The narration of Amsterdam talking over everything that's going on, who the players are. I was 100% getting Goodfellas vibes.
Right?
I was like, you're literally like, this is such an homage to that, or like a variation on that. I'm like, got it.
And it really feels like everything he was building towards in that first half of his career, to the point where I don't know if you knew this, but like he was trying to get this movie made for about 20 years. Like he worked on this project for like a long time. And then after all that development, finally, he originally actually apparently had like a longer cut, but the Weinstein Company was the one that made the cut. And that's why, you know, notorious producer, not great dude, and person who, as I've talked about before, likes to cut down movies. Big old creep Harvey Weinstein wanted to cut about 20 minutes of the movie. So there is like a 3-hour like clean cut out there that I would love to see. But apparently Marty's like, no, this is my final vision. So, I think it does really like kind of also show where the rest of Scorsese's career would spring to. And like, this is like a period piece, and he'd done some sort of period pieces before, but not like a big historical epic like this. And I love that later Scorsese starts getting into different genres and stuff. Like he comes out with like another film I've covered on here, Silence, Hugo. Yes. It's like, I'm Martin Scorsese. I'm just going to make this 3D kids film about the silent era of movies. You're like, okay, cool. I fucking love that movie. And so, and Shutter Island, a like weird thriller. Like he got weird with it. And I think that, you can really point to this one to be like, this is the exact kind of middle of his career. And I mean, I think it captures so much of what I like from both later and early Scorsese.
And you mentioned Silence. One thing that I found interesting, I was kind of like looking into the writing team of this. I believe Jay Cox is one of the ones that wrote Silence as well as this. And I definitely see like, there was a lot of like religious undertones, obviously with priests and like how much the church is an extension of England and all that stuff. And I found like that blending in with the historical elements of the conflict here was really interesting. It wasn't just a culture coming here. It was the fact that the way Bill was seeing things, it was the church, and the church is run by, and they were like, is an extension of this country. And we fought that country. That's why we left. That's what America is. And so mm-hmm. this is like, he saw that as an invasion in some ways of those beliefs and what the virtues that he stood by. So I agree. I think there was like definitely like, this was one of those paradigm shifts for Scorsese of like, how does he take his future films and mm-hmm. where does he go and what kind of things does he work? I think he went in a lot of different directions, and I think they all came out of more polished after having this had a big, like the scope and scale of it. Like it was mm-hmm. covering the city. It was covering a lot of subject matter. It was covering a revenge story. There was romance. There was, you know, the city conflict, the historical aspects.
I think it's an epic. It truly is. Yeah.
The length of the cut and like just how long of a film it was. I feel like most of his other films, while they cover like a wide variety of a cast, like they're more contained stories. They're more more intimate stories on a smaller scale. And I like that he kind of like dabbled, like this was him trying, testing the waters with that and then succeeding and going forth to do other stuff with it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Stretching his muscles as it were.
Yeah. And I'm really glad you brought up the religious stuff, because I think that's something that is so key to this movie and so key to Scorsese's entire filmography. I talked a lot about on our Silence episode how I love the way that like Catholic guilt and like religious trauma and like trying to figure out all that stuff is covered so interestingly, and like crises of faith and stuff like that. And I think that is a real through line in Scorsese's career. And I think that another big thing is going all the way back to, you know, one of his first films, Mean Streets, is like the religion that people talk about and say, and then they go and like they'll go pray in the church and then go right out and just have these just acts of insane violence. Yeah. And Scorsese talked about like that was him as a kid. And he talks about a lot of times he's like, yeah, I would grow up in these streets where I would see, you know, you can very much imagine him being like young Leo in that first scene. And kind of like seeing this huge gang war happen, all this violence happened, and people are like, oh yeah, but you know, make sure you go pray. You know, like you said, his dad in this is literally a priest. He's like, he's Priest Valentine, goes out there with that like big cross that he uses to kill people or whatever. Like, and so I've always been way more interested in that aspect of Scorsese's career when he touches on the kind of dichotomy of like religion and what that means and his own growing up with like Catholic guilt has meant mm-hmm. for him than like just like a traditional mobster movie that he's maybe more famous for. I've always really been interested in that kind of stuff.
I mean, it was like, this is also, isn't like you said, Mean Streets, you were talking about The Last Temptation of Christ.
Yeah.
You know, being a very direct conversation about that subject matter. But a lot of other, like, I think it is a theme that he doesn't ignore. And I think is very important to him and to what, you know, it causes conflict in character. You see it, it drives, it's what can motivate some characters. It can drive characters to conflicts and, you know, different ideologies and stuff like that. So, yeah, I definitely find that, I appreciated that in a lot of ways, the just what he did with it in this film and where it fit within all the different subject matter already there that was loaded. It was just a powder keg. The film as a whole, like powder keg, is like the perfect way to sum it up for me.
Yeah, like built to the literal explosion there at the end. And yeah, something too I was going to say earlier was like, because you talked about the powder keg and building and building, and then as I kind of was saying, like, it just, what is it? It maybe didn't mean anything in the end. And I love that last shot. You talked about how Scorsese is so great with the imagery. And you see the final result of this is they're both the priest and Bill are dead. They have these gravestones overlooking the city. And over the years, they just slowly, slowly fade away, literally and figuratively. And at the end, it's like, what happened? It's all gone. It's all washed away. And even like Leo's last lines in the movie are really saying something to that effect.
Yeah. I think one of the things it's like, it was in the early part, it was like with the priest and the memory of, or lack thereof of him in that area where he was such an important figure at that time. And as time went on, just people forget the dead rabbits. They forget the priest. They forget all these things. It just showed it as a larger picture at the end of like, yeah, not only that conflict, but just generations and generations mm-hmm. passing by, and you know, you lose sight of the history, you lose sight of the conflict, mm-hmm. you lose sight of the tension, and you also lose sight that it, like Brendan Gleeson's character was saying, like, this isn't a new conflict. This mm-hmm. has been going on, and and I think that kind of like that shot captures all of that and saying like the cycle, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And this is, like we said, this is a historical film. We both agree, like, this is clearly an epic on a bigger scale than probably Scorsese has ever done. I don't know, maybe, but it's definitely up there, you know. And you know, to the point where, like, they had to essentially, like,
set either, pieces, all that stuff.
Yeah, all that stuff. They had to build like old New York City in like I think Italy, because, or maybe Portugal, because those parts of just New York just don't exist anymore. And so they built these huge, extensive sets and had like all these extras and all this stuff. And I think that I talked about it when I talked about kind of older films. We did this miniseries talking about old movies. And one of the ones I talked about was Zulu, and how that kind of genre of filmmaking, these big epics with these sets and all these actors and stuff, and these historical amazing settings that are recreated, have kind of gone away. And I feel like the early 2000s was kind of the last, like, you get Gladiator and then you get this, and you still might get like a superhero quote unquote epic, like Avengers or something maybe. But
like Lord of the Rings comes to mind.
Yeah. Yeah. Lord of the Rings, which was like, the same time period, like, you know, the second one came out the same year as this. And so I felt like this was the kind of end of that epic storytelling or epic kind of movie. I don't know. Are there any other ones more recently you could think of, or what do you think about?
I think I agree. I think there's definitely, I mean, it's, from a Hollywood standpoint, it makes sense, because like the amount of the film industry has been so volatile, it seems, mm-hmm. like in a lot of ways, and they're just sticking to the, even more so, like it's not new, but in more so, unless they really trust a creative team or a creative owner or someone like a Scorsese or someone like that, they don't really go out on a limb with saying like, yeah, go shoot on location. Mm-hmm. If it's more than one location, like even one location could be, to my knowledge, like that seems like they're very much like, why do that when we have mm-hmm. all these technological tools at our disposal that can make anything happen wherever, you know, like, I think there's definitely I agree. I think that's much fewer and far between now. And you might see it maybe on more like what are deemed artistic or independent films, where they're just kind of like, we're going to do a little bit out of the norm, and we're going to be in this location. It's going to feel immersive. It's going to feel just very, I don't know. It's going to have a different feeling to it. Like, and it'll be either one location or a very, just they're off in some, who knows where, like a desert. I'm trying to think of a few films. I think a lot of times I think of like sci-fi films that are on the lower production end of that. And none are coming to mind off the top of my head, but yeah, I do think that generation was kind of like the last where you'd see it on a larger scale with Gladiator, with Lord of the Rings, with some of the other films.
Yeah. Cause I feel like you got to be basically Chris Nolan to get to be able to be like, okay, I'm going to get a lot of money and shoot on location. Cause even like the recent Indiana Jones movie, which had a huge budget, which I liked a lot, did not do well at the box office at all.
This episode is brought to you by Twizzlers. Long day, late night, feeling a little bored. Twizzlers is the ultimate sidekick for any moment of the day, no matter what kind of day you're having. The perfect level of sweet and a fun excuse to sit back and relax. Unwind with Twizzlers. To buy now, visit Hersheyland.com/Twizzlers.
But yeah, As before we wrap up here, any kind of stray thoughts or anything on gangs in New York?
I'm just thinking, I'm looking at the, I wanted to talk briefly, I guess, about some of the way the shots were. There were moments where it wasn't even like particular action shots. I think it did occur sometimes in the more frantic scenes, whether it was like the dance moments or the fight at the very beginning of the Battle of the Five Points. Where it was just like this kind of like the frames looked like they were like lagging and kind of like a slow-mo kind of
surreal effect. I had that in my notes too. That's something like Scorsese, it's like a trademark of his where like it'll like stop and then it'll like go like a frame later. Like it's like something he's done in a lot of his films.
That and a few other things that just, I know it's in his like bag of tricks of like different kind of things, but there was another moment that was like when the McGlowan was at Valen's camp towards the end, and then and then he turns and he's like, "Father, did you know there's a black guy in the church?" Yeah. And then the father just like, he's like, he turns and then he does like this weird, the way that the camera captured him throwing a brick or something at the guy's head gave me Sam Raimi vibes. Like, some of these shots just felt kind of very hyper stylized and interesting in that way, where I was like, it felt like he had like a mix, like maybe he was dabbling in some stuff like early what's the Lord of the Rings?
Peter Jackson.
Yes, Peter Jackson. Yeah. Oh, or early Peter Jackson, or like a Sam Raimi stylistic like action shots, like the way the camera just sways with a shot or a scene.
Yeah, almost like Kubrickian, like, you know, where you're like Jack with the axe or whatever.
Yeah, some scenes like that moment, not all, but there were little bits that would just throw me off. I'm like, oh, that was interesting. Like it really caught my eye. It stuck with me in terms of like the way the shots were done or the framing or anything like that. So I found that interesting.
Yeah, I think the one you brought up, it's interesting because I think Scorsese is such a like man, and I know it's like also his DPs and his cinematographers too, but like,
yeah,
he's such a master of just the way everything is framed. You already talked about the last shot and then that long tracking shot, which obviously he's so famous for his long tracking shots. But that one where you kind of see the, you know, the guy hit him in the priest hit McGlorian in the head, I think is one of the funniest moments in the movie and speaks to how like funny just editing can be, because it like hard cuts to like him walking all angry with a big fucking bandage on his head. I remember I just started cracking up because he's just like, he just says this thing that like, you know, he drops the hard end and you're like, oh man, screw this guy. And then he like baps him in the head and it just like cuts to the end. You're like, God, you're like laughing and you're like clapping. You're like, good.
Yeah,
through that guy. Yeah. Through that guy.
And then the next shot, you see that guy marching with the bill and he's just got like a little bandage on his head. He's like,
Yeah, exactly. It's such a good cut. It's so funny. I love it. Yeah.
Yeah, that. And then I would say there was one other thing I was going to say. In terms of humor, the other thing that came to mind was when John C. Reilly's character was like, I'm having a conflict. You know, like, I do what's right for the law. And Daniel Lee's like, what are you even saying?
He's like, what the fuck are you talking about?
But he's like, almost like a, is this city guard? Like, it's like every aspect of the city, he's like, is it? He's realizing it's moving in weirder, dumber directions.
Yeah.
And he's like, he felt like, I think in that moment, he felt like very much like a disgruntled. And he pulls out, he's like, I'm just so sad for this poor. And then he starts crying and he's like,
he does that fucking face. It's so good. And then he, like, the way he ends it, he just kind of like looks at him like, do your fucking job. It's so good. And I kind of love like that the like whole thing he represents is he's just like, he's kind of the old cranky way of thinking. He's just like, we can't have these immigrants coming down to our shores. And it's like, the old ways are the best. And he's like, they literally call themselves Native Americans, even though he's been here for like one or two generations at most. Like, he's like, yeah, my dad died in the War of 1812. Like, his dad might have even been from England, but he's like, it's so ridiculous.
I think there's an ego to him like, I am America.
Yeah, yeah.
I like when he wears the flag as like a mourning, like robe almost. Like, you know,
that eagle would have a single blue line in it if it was made today. Like, you know.
Yeah, even his eye had a
like
there was an eagle in there and all that stuff. Yeah.
Blue lives matter, Leo. Did I tell you?
You do a good impression. Thanks. Yeah, you know, I hope there's clips of him and Neeson. Like, I want to see a blooper reel or something.
That'd be so fucking good.
I feel like that's almost. The only other story I've heard of like such like conflict like that was Tommy Lee Jones and Jim Carrey.
Jim Carrey? Oh my god! You gotta tell the story. It's so good.
Yeah, like just on the set of, what was it, Batman and Robin?
Batman Forever.
And how much Tommy Lee Jones hated just the energy and the vibe that like Jim Carrey was bringing off set, like between takes and all that stuff. He's like, I hate this guy. I hate him so much. Wasn't it also like he said it on an interview or something? Or
well, yeah, Jim Carrey was like, yeah, so he wasn't like vibing with my whole thing. That was like when Jim Carrey was at his most Jim Carrey and like Tommy Lee Jones was at his crankiest old man, you know?
Yeah. It's so funny. I think like that.
Yeah, let me see, because like he apparently like went up to him and like, oh, okay, this is the greatest line. Like Jim Carrey was like, hey man, what's the problem? And what Tommy Lee Jones said back to him was, I cannot sanction your buffoonery. Just one of my all-time great lines from behind the scenes.
Yeah, oh, that's cool, man. Okay. Yeah.
All right. I just had one more question before we wrap up. And because I like to, on Underrated, we've always kind of ended with questions. I'm trying to bring that back. And so, you know, we talked a lot about how this is kind of a great historical film. Do you have any great historical, you know, any great movies that are like historical epics or even just like, you know, ones that are these great period dramas or anything like that?
100%. There's one of my all-time faves. And it matters if you're watching the, I got to check real quick if it's the uncut or the director's cut. But Kingdom of Heaven.
Okay, yeah. That is. I'm not going to lie. That is one that I have maybe, I don't want to reveal too much, but I have maybe something in the pipeline about doing Kingdom of Heaven and the difference between the director's cut and theatrical.
The director's cut is one of my favorite movies. And Liam Neeson's in that one too. As a badass.
That's a great movie. Ridley Scott always has really good director's cuts.
Yes, and that was, I love that film so much. So I would highly recommend, it's I believe more of like a historical drama in the biblical times, crusade times. So I would highly recommend, that would be my answer.
That is a really good pick. I'd have to say probably my favorite historical film is Amadeus. You ever see that? You almost thought you might be talking about it because there's a director's cut of that one too.
I have not had the pleasure of fully, I've seen parts. I haven't seen the whole thing.
It's
on my to-do list.
That's one. Yeah, I would say definitely check out. It's a movie that deeply resonates with me. It's, you know, another movie that is very darkly funny and relatable in certain aspects to me. So
nice.
Yeah, I love it. So anybody listening and you as well, I would highly recommend it too.
Thank you.
Thank you again for coming on. Everybody, you know, out there listening, check Kurosh out, Cujo Prime. He's a Twitch streamer. He does all the stuff. Yeah, he's a man of many talents.
You can find me at twitch.tv/@CujoPrime or @CujoPrime. And you can find me at youtube.com/@CujoPrime and then on Cujo Prime on all social platforms.
All right. Yeah. Excellent. Yeah. What are you doing over there? Like, just to give the people a taste.
On the streaming side, on the gaming side, it's right now lots of Tetris. I'm the self-proclaimed most charismatic Tetris player there is.
I second that.
There's a lot of really good Tetris players, but they don't have they can't talk the talk. They can't walk the walk.
They don't have that glitz in their eye like you do.
Yeah, yeah. And so I'd say on the gaming side, that's what I'm up to. That's my current forte of things. In addition to that, on YouTube, I've been beginning to do a series of interviews with game developers.
Oh, nice.
Shedding light on like a lot of what they do on various games, largely independent games on the smaller scale, but to give folks an idea of like what those games are like, what the development process is like from different perspectives. I just finished one earlier today. I have another one after this. So I'll be putting more of those out on YouTube so you can see. I have a couple out already on YouTube, so you can see those there.
Yeah, definitely. There will be a link in the description to his stuff. So definitely click on that, check that out. And once you're done giving him all the love and attention he deserves, you can check out some more Underrated stuff. It's going to be at underratedmoviepodcast.com. Been doing some stuff on TikTok. I've been having a lot of fun there. There's a lot of cool TikTokers who are like film TikTok people that I've been, you know, making videos like in response to and stuff like that. And then I also should mention that starting a new Patreon. So specifically, yeah, for the Underrated Movie Podcast. So just getting started. And by the time this is out, we will have released our first episode of the new Patreon exclusive show where we are talking about specifically sports movies. So I talked about Moneyball with Craig from Hooks and Runs. That was really fun. So if you want to hear some stuff that is less underrated, more universally beloved, check that out. You know, that's for $3 a month, but there's also an option to do just $1 a month if you want to just support that way. And you also get episodes early, provided I can edit them early, if you sign up at least that $1 level. And if you sign up for $5, then we'll let you pick an episode once you've been a patron for 5 months. So we got all kinds of good benefits there. But yeah.
Something for everyone.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you. But yeah, check out Underrated and all that stuff on all the socials, Underrated Movie Podcast. Of course, check out Cujo Prime as well. One last time, thank you so much for coming on. This has been a blast.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
And I'll see you next time, man.